content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Steve Lord from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to a half hour of captivating developments in science, medicine, technology, and the world around us, as reported in Discover, the magazine of science. Today's episode from the January-February 2018 issue of Discover magazine, which features the top 100 science stories of 2017, contains 18 brief stories from that issue. A Flu Fighter's Fall from Grace. When Tamiflu came on the market in 1999, it promised to curtail severe influenza symptoms and even save lives, especially among the frail elderly and the chronically ill. In 2010, in the midst of the H1N1 swine flu pandemic, the World Health Organization, WHO, designated Tamiflu as an essential medication, encouraging governments to stockpile it. As a result, the drug has generated over $9 billion in sales worldwide just from government purchases. But Roche, Tamiflu's maker, had buried the results of several clinical trials. Independent reviews of this unpublished research in 2012 and 2014 found no evidence that Tamiflu reduced hospitalizations or deaths. It also caused adverse effects. That should have been the end of Tamiflu. But it was not until June that WHO finally downgraded the drug on its list of core medications. Critics blasted both WHO's delay and Roche's failure to release all of the clinical trial data, including some of the largest studies. University of Georgia epidemiologist Mark Ebell, who analyzed some of the unpublished data, echoed an editorial in the British Medical Journal when he called the situation a multi-system failure that diverted public health dollars into buying a marginally effective drug instead of using them for research into better treatments or more pressing health concerns. Ice storms on Mars. A new weather simulation predicts nighttime snow flurries on arid Mars, shedding light on how the red planet's scarce water supplies move through the atmosphere. In 2008, the Phoenix lander observed snowfall in Mars's sky, but scientists believed the snow, falling under its own slight weight, would take hours to drift down and would probably evaporate before hitting the ground. The new research, published in August in Nature Geoscience, shows nighttime air currents are turbulent, with convection strong enough to churn the snow down in a matter of minutes, resulting in more reaching the ground. While the amount of snow is minimal, that precipitation would be a crucial step in Mars's water cycle, both present and past. Lead author and planetary scientist Aymeric Spiga at the University Pierre at Marie Curie in Paris says that the snow in his model is more like an ice storm of tiny particles than Earth's intricate fluffy flakes. Standing on Mars early in the morning, you would see it as a very thin and sparse frost, he says. Earth's hot pockets. A couple of decades ago, seismologists noticed some strange behavior below Earth's surface. Seismic waves that normally pass through the planet's inner layers with ease got caught up in the rocky lower mantle, roughly halfway to Earth's center. The waves slowed down by as much as 30%. Scientists surmised the ripples had hit partially molten pockets and dubbed the areas ultra-low velocity zones, ULVZs. In August, geologists reported in Nature Communications that they overlaid ULVZ locations with computer models of the heat flow through the mantle and spotted something interesting. The pockets aren't situated in places hot enough to melt the lower mantle's rock. Therefore, they must be made of minerals with a lower melting point, says Arizona State University geophysicist Mingming Li, the study's lead author. Although the region's precise composition remains unknown, their geological distinctiveness suggests mantle materials never fully mixed even over billions of years. Deciphering this mystery undoubtedly holds a key to understanding the evolution of our planet, Lee says. A better way to control pain? Today's painkillers target the brain and spinal cord. But in April, neuroscientists reported that there might be a better way to block pain before it makes it to those central systems. An international team of researchers found that peripheral nerves play an unexpected role in processing pain. Experts had thought these cells merely relayed information to the spinal cord, which integrates other incoming pain signals and sends them to the brain for interpretation. During this process, both the brain and spinal cord use chemical messengers, or neurotransmitters, to turn pain up or down. Scientists believed this ability was limited to the brain and spinal cord. But the team noticed that in rodents, neurons near the spine used a neurotransmitter called gamma-aminobutyric acid, GABA, to dial back pain signals before sending them on. When the researchers administered GABA to those neurons in rats, the animals hardly reacted to a painful injection into their paws. The finding, published in the Journal of Clinical Investigation, might radically change how we treat pain, assuming it holds up for humans too, says senior author Nikita Gamper. Painkillers that act on peripheral nerves, he says, would have far fewer side effects and shouldn't be addictive. A towering Aztec ritual uncovered. According to Aztec beliefs, gods died to create the world, and people owed them a debt to be repaid through large-scale human sacrifices. Accounts by 16th-century Spanish colonists painted a grisly picture. Miles-long lines of victims awaiting such a fate, and more than 100,000 severed heads strung along a zompatli, or skull rack, at Templo Mayor, the great temple. The colonists exaggerated the death tolls, but sacrifices and zompatli were real. Some of the victims resurfaced in July when archaeologists uncovered a tower made from more than 650 human skulls near the ruins of Templo Mayor in Mexico City. Skulls were likely added to the tower after public display on the nearby zompatli, indicated by rows of 10-inch holes that once held wooden posts supporting the skull rack. Of the 171 skulls studied so far, most victims were young men, likely captured enemy warriors, but some were women and children. DNA and isotopic analysis, currently underway, should determine where in Central America the victims originated. When did life appear? As a faint young sun shone on our freshly formed Earth around 4 billion years ago, primitive creatures, each less than half the width of a human hair, were thriving around volcanic vents. That's the conclusion of an international team of geoscientists who announced in March in Nature they'd unearthed these creatures' remains. The microfossils, potentially the oldest discovered, were locked inside rocks in remote northern Canada that were 3.8 billion to 4.3 billion years old, roughly when scientists think life started. But that wasn't the only finding this year that suggested life on Earth is older than we thought. In September, Japanese geoscientists publishing in Nature said they'd also found traces of 3.95 billion-year-old life forms in different northern Canadian rocks. Some critics doubt the age claims of both studies and say the samples need more rigorous testing before anything can be confirmed. But the findings fit an emerging consensus that life began around 4 billion years ago, a period when comets and asteroids bombarded Earth. Until relatively recently, scientists thought such impacts would have sterilized our world until roughly 3.8 billion years ago. But new evidence is suggesting those craters helped create hydrothermal vents that set the stage for life to emerge. This makes life appear to be a relatively easy process to kickstart on the planet, says Matthew Dodd of University College London and lead author on the March paper. Curiosity killed the cat, but ancient DNA revealed its backstory. Ancient Egypt has long been considered the domestic cat's cradle, but when researchers sequenced DNA from more than 200 ancient cats, they discovered that, while Nile natives formed the most broadly distributed lineage, they were not the first. Paleogeneticist Claudio Attini, lead author of the June study in Nature, Ecology, and Evolution, says according to DNA records, the first wave of feline domestication occurred about 6,400 years ago in Southwest Asia through Southeast Europe, but it remained a regional affair. Egyptian cats conquered the household sometime after that, Attani says. By the 8th century BC, they'd spread rapidly via trade routes throughout the Mediterranean and across Asia and the Indian Ocean. The study also showed that, unlike domesticated animals seen mostly as sources of meat or labor, cats served as companions and useful pest control agents aboard ships, hence their global dispersal. The success of cats in spreading across long and short geographical ranges was linked to a strong relationship between them and humans, Attani says. Evolutionarily speaking, cats are one of the most successful species, but it happened because humans really liked them. Football's latest injury report. It's hard-hitting news. Of 111 former NFL players' brains, 110 showed signs of chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE. CTE is a brain disease caused by repeated hits to the head that lead to memory loss and mood and personality changes, such as increased impulsivity, violence, and depression. The study, published in July in the Journal of the American Medical Association and the largest of its kind, examined the brains of 202 people who had all played football at some point in their lives. The disease permeated all levels of the sport. 48 of 53 college players and 3 of 14 high school players' brains showed some signs of CTE. However, because the sample included a number of brains donated by family members who noticed symptoms, it isn't representative of all former football players. Still, Anne McKee, the study's senior author, thinks the results warrant changes, such as introducing kids to the sport when they're older and limiting the number of games and full contact practices. Even though this is a biased sample, the sheer volume of the numbers indicates that the problem is more prevalent than previously considered, McKee says. It's concerning. 24-hour watch. Early bird or night owl? You can thank evolution. Staggered natural sleep patterns, or chronotypes, may have kept our species alive. Having a few members of a group awake at all times can protect everyone from predators and other threats. This idea, known as the sentinel hypothesis, was proposed in the 1960s and demonstrated in some birds and rodents. In July, in Proceedings of the Royal Society B, researchers described the first evidence for the sentinel hypothesis in humans. The team used wrist monitors to track the sleep patterns of 33 members of Tanzania's Hadza people, whose environment and hunter-gatherer lifestyle are similar to those of early humans. The findings? During more than 220 hours of data collection, there were only 18 one-minute increments when all participants were soundly asleep. Age had the strongest influence on chronotype. Participants aged 50 and older were more likely to be early birds than those 30 and younger. "We're incredibly different from our ancestors in so many ways," says Duke University evolutionary anthropologist Charles Nunn, a researcher involved in the study. "Yet, understanding that past can help us understand our behavior and physiology today." To the Moon and Back, an astronaut's loving tribute finally acknowledged. In 1968, as navigator on Apollo 8, the first mission around the moon, Jim Lovell carefully documented his path above the Sea of Tranquility, where NASA would land Apollo 11. He spotted a small pyramid-shaped mountain near the landing site and named it Mount Marilyn after his wife. Lovell knew he wouldn't forget the landmark. Mount Marilyn proved vital on Apollo 11 when Neil Armstrong relied on it for navigation during a harrowing landing. And yet the mountain is among dozens of features named by astronauts but not on official moon maps. For nearly half a century, astronomy's official nomenclature group, the International Astronomical Union, IAU, wouldn't make any of the names official. Scientists used an asterisk if they cited them. But in July, after multiple applications by Lovell and Arizona State University astronomer Mark Robinson, the IAU reversed course for three of the landmarks, including Mount Marilyn, without explanation. Lovell, who kept the campaign a secret from Marilyn, enjoyed revealing it at last. "She was quite amazed," Lovell says. In exploration, there's romanticism, too. Going deep. Deep brain stimulation is a valuable therapeutic tool, allowing experts to target specific brain cells to help treat disorders like Parkinson's disease and obsessive-compulsive disorder. The catch? Activating specific buried neurons requires sticking electrodes directly into the brain, a technique that involves risky surgery. In June, an international team of researchers reported it had developed a non-invasive way to stimulate neurons deep in the brain using electrodes placed on the scalp. Their method relies on what's called temporal interference. Essentially, the electrodes are set at two different frequencies that are normally too high to activate neurons. But in the spots where the currents cross paths, that interaction generates a lower frequency to which neurons respond. Since these slivers of low-frequency currents depend on the electrode's placement, researchers can easily arrange them on the scalp to get at those hard-to-reach neurons while leaving other neurons untouched. The work, published in Cell, has only been tested on mice, but if it proves viable in humans, it could open the door to therapy for people struggling to cope with neurological disorders. Scan is fast and budget-friendly. Sometimes tackling a large project on a small budget leads to a huge innovation. Forensic dentists wanted close-up scans of the jaw of Sue, the famed T-Rex that resides at Chicago's Field Museum. But their equipment wasn't big enough to scan Sue's 5-foot-long skull, so the dino dentists turned to the group Camera Culture, part of MIT's Media Lab. Their fix, announced in July, a video game camera about the size of a can of tennis balls that creates a 3D map called a point cloud, plus some free software to analyze it. The cost? $150. An image from the new technique, which uses a Microsoft Kinect Xbox One camera and MeshLab software, isn't the best quality. Its resolution stops at 500 micrometers. That's just a bit bigger than the average grain of table salt. High-end scanners, which cost $30,000, can go as low as 50 micrometers. But Camera Culture's approach is cheap and fast. Scanning Sue's entire skull took just 2 minutes. Museums can now create virtual models for outreach and education without busting their budget, and possible research applications abound. Roman neighborhood frozen in time. Late in the 1st century AD, a fire struck a neighborhood in the Roman city of Vienne, 20 miles south of Lyon, France. The fire baked the building's bricks and spread so quickly that inhabitants abandoned their belongings. Several other fires struck the area over the following centuries. 2 millennia later, the same spot was selected for a housing development. As mandated by the French government, The land underwent archaeological inspection in April by a private company, Archaeodunum, which found structures several meters below grade. The intensity of the first conflagration had preserved many of the aspects of the neighborhood, since fired brick doesn't crumble and heat treatment protects iron from corrosion. Archaeologists found ancient streets, mosaics, shops, and multi-story houses. Personal belongings like wine jugs and a wooden chest containing a Roman soldier's armor were also unearthed. This is an exceptional chance to analyze the houses of rich and poor alike and study the architecture of multi-story buildings, says Archaeodunum archaeologist Benjamin Clement. Breathless Wonders. Somehow, naked mole rats got even weirder in 2017. It turns out the cold-blooded, cancer-resistant, pain-immune, and conspicuously long-lived rodents also can survive for extended periods of time without oxygen. In tests at the University of Illinois at Chicago, biologists, carefully, deprived naked mole rats of oxygen for 18 minutes. In a separate test, the researchers kept them for more than 5 hours at dangerously low oxygen levels. Both times, the naked mole rats were unharmed. Most animals need oxygen to survive because it helps convert blood sugar, or glucose, into energy. No oxygen, no life. In the study, published in April in Science, researchers found that naked mole rats use glucose this way too. But it turns out their bodies can switch things up and efficiently metabolize fructose. It's a different kind of sugar that doesn't require oxygen to provide life-sustaining energy. These insights into oxygenless survival could one day help stroke and heart attack patients, for whom every minute without oxygen is critical. Sweet Science, a cross-cultural marshmallow test. The universal struggle, choosing between immediate gratification and long-term rewards. The marshmallow test, a psychology classic from the early 70s, evaluates this skill, called self-regulation, in children. A researcher asks a child to sit alone in a room with a treat. The child can eat it right away, but waiting 10 to 15 minutes for the researcher to return will grant the child a second treat. Previously, experts tested primarily Western children. But in June, German psychologists published the first marshmallow test using Western and non-Western participants, about 200 kids total. The team found that 4-year-olds from Cameroonian farming families in West Africa bested their German middle-class counterparts. Only 28% of the German children earned an extra treat, whereas 70% of the Cameroonian children scored a second one. 10% even fell asleep waiting. These children differ in many ways, so the dramatic results, reported in Child Development, likely stem from a blend of influences. Next, the researchers say they want to investigate strategies the children used to help them wait. Music to my brain. As a jazz musician and neurologist at Swedish Medical Center in Seattle, Thomas Duell has always been sensitive to the plight of performers paralyzed by brain and spinal injuries. He also has a lot of experience with electroencephalography, EEG, a non-invasive way of measuring brain activity, which can be harnessed to control wheelchairs. Several years ago, he started to wonder, could the technology apply to musical instruments too? Thus was born his new instrument, the encephalophone, described in April in Frontiers in Human Neuroscience. It's the first device to translate electrical brain activity directly to a musical scale, allowing performance without physical movement. Patients control the encephalophone by imagining their right hand grasping and releasing. A sensor cap detects the changing brain patterns, which alter the frequency of a continuous tone on a synthesizer speaker. The sensation is very bizarre at first, but competence improves with practice, Duell says. He's already planning for his patients to perform live alongside ensemble musicians at the University of Washington. The encephalophone may have its greatest impact on physical therapy, potentially benefiting even non-performers. The hope is there will be accelerated recovery of the motor cortex, Duell says. The simulation of playing may help stroke patients regain motor control. Sniffing out the truth. Rutgers University neuroscientist John McGann, an olfaction researcher, has long been puzzled by claims that people have a feeble sense of smell. In his lab, humans perform as well as rodents and dogs in some tests. Research by his colleagues suggests our species can distinguish a trillion different odors. In a May review published in Science, McGann finally sniffed out the source of the foul-smelling rumor. The main culprit is Paul Broca, a leading 19th-century anatomist who observed that the brain's olfactory bulb, where we detect smells, is proportionally puny compared with other mammals. He accepted the near-universal belief in human exceptionalism and looked in the brain for evidence of it, says McGann. For Broca, a weak sense of smell elevated us above brute animal instinct. His beliefs were adopted by others, even Sigmund Freud. What Broca missed, McGann points out, is that relative bulb size doesn't matter. Bigger animals have bigger noses, but that doesn't mean they also need bigger olfactory systems. When it comes to smell, we're animals. And knowing that could help scientists better understand human behavior, emotion, and even memory. Birds' egg shapes explained. The eggs we scramble and fry typically span a humdrum range of colors, sizes, and shapes. But the avian kingdom lays eggs of vast variation. When it comes to shape, biologists have long wondered why, say, muirs have pointy eggs, yet ostrich's eggs are rounder. Aristotle suggested males come from rounder eggs, and others suggested elongated eggs wouldn't roll off cliffs. In a June paper in Science, researchers finally cracked the case. Princeton's Mary Caswell Stoddard and her team examined some 50,000 eggs from 1,400 species provided by the Museum of Vertebrate Zoology at Berkeley. They found no nesting habitat links, but did see a pattern correlating with flight ability. Frequent flyers, like muirs, have streamlined bodies and more elliptical eggs, while birds who like their feet on the ground, say ostriches, have rounder ones. So overall, it's the bird that shapes the egg, forever proving which comes first. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover, the magazine of science. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. Till then, expand your mind. I'm Steve Lord, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.